This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
A warm welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website this week. And after last week's budget, we've had more twists and U-turns than at Silverstone, but no brakes being put on a number of hikes and cuts that get impact that pound in your pocket, I'm afraid. The flat rate of VAT set to rise, the cut in dividend allowance ploughs on, as does changes to road tax.
The system just seems dreadfully complicated, perhaps just like when the government changed the tax on diesel. There are always unintended consequences.
We got some good news this week. Unemployment fell.
4.7% unemployment, the lowest for 12 years. Last time it was lower, was in the mid-1970s. We've got a new high in terms of the number of people in work.
But is all as it seems. Wage growth is rubbish and we've more zero-hour contracts. Also, no change in the base rate of interest from the Bank of England, but that doesn't mean mortgage rates will stay low. Rates on savings accounts probably will, though. Some worrying stats about how few of us are saving or investing.
The figures are startling, really, you know. And as a nation, we're not a nation of savers, we're a nation of spenders.
Perhaps it's time we all became minor investors, eh, Simon? You've been tapping away on your laptop, and for your blog this week, you're looking at five of the best dividend hero investment trusts to consider for an ISA. And an in-house gym, Death Star Cinema, Beer Fridays. Have This Is Money found the best boss in Britain in internet guru Chris Morning? Well, apart from Simon Lambert, obviously. Apparently never shouts at staff, quote, no matter how irritating I find them. So I want to know, quite simply, what makes a great boss for you? Rachel, an opportunity for you. Your boss is in the studio at the moment. But generally, what makes a great boss for you?
Gosh, this is uncomfortable. So I'm going to speak in general terms about research that I've read. quoted by Tim Harford in his book Messy, which contradicts, I think, the methods of the what was quoted by the Daily Mail as the best boss in the world. So it's all about, rather than imposing your ideas of sort of quirky working areas and things, you should provide ownership over those choices to your staff, and it's that creates more staff retention, makes staff happier. If they feel like they are more in control, that is preferable than saying, oh, we're going to have, you know, whatever they had, strangely decorated rooms in the vision of the proprietor.
So no Beer Fridays then?
If they all want beer, yes. But what if they prefer Prosecco?
Prosecco Fridays, I'm sure, could work as well. I mean, I haven't spoken to Chris Morning. For me, I think it's a boss that is secure enough to surround himself or herself with staff who are, well, more talented than they are and bring out the best in their staff, which I imagine, Simon, you do all of this great stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any beer or Prosecco.
No.
But, you know, there's a pub over the road, so people are welcome to go there if they want. Not too much, not all day long.
If they've done the work.
Yeah, exactly. I think that I've been lucky enough to have some great bosses over the years, and I think that the most important thing that you can do is take people and trust them to do their job and trust them to do the best job that they can and to guide them along the way. And to encourage them to explore their job and push it and do different things with it that they want to do whilst, you know, keeping up with the day job and what they have to do. And just to build a sort of culture of people being interested in what they're doing and nice to other people and just genuinely trying to do the best thing that they can possibly do. And I think that in the environments that I've worked in where people have done that and they've put their faith in their staff and, you know, gone, right, well, if I've employed you to do this job, I've presumably decided that you're good enough to do it, so I'm going to leave you alone to do it to the best of your ability. The environments where I've worked in where that's been the case have been the best environments that I've worked in.
How would you categorise your leadership style, Simon?
My leadership style is probably reasonably relaxed.
And I'm looking over at Rachel there.
One of trying to just encourage people, you know. I mean, I think that sometimes, though, people need much more stringent framework around them, though. There are some people who don't really work so well in that kind of environment, and so you need to recognise when you need to take a step back and when you actually need to take a step forward and actually say to someone, look, right, I need you to do A, B, C and D, and this is how you do it.
It's the Alec Ferguson School of Man Management. And Rachel was nodding along, by the way, Simon.
On digital radio across the UK and online, this is Share Radio.
I'm Georgie Frost. Here with me are the team from This Is Money for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. Editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Coming up, we'll be talking about savings, investing and good bosses. But first, Simon, Rachel, we have an apology for our listeners. We like to give you accurate news that affects your finances, but it appears we might have misled you. Now, last week, we got a series of announcements in the budget, which we told you about in good faith and a week on. Well, it appears one of those isn't quite right, but it was not our fault.
Mr. Speaker, the measures I announced in the budget sought to reflect more fairly the differences in entitlement in the contributions made by the self-employed. The government continues to believe that addressing this unfairness is the right approach. However, Mr. Speaker, since the budget, parliamentary colleagues and others have questioned whether the proposed increase in Class 4 contributions is compatible with the tax lock commitments made in our 2015 manifesto. Ahead of autumn statement last year, the Prime Minister and I decided that however difficult the fiscal challenges we face, the tax lock and spending ring fence commitments we have made for this Parliament should be honoured in full. As far as national insurance contributions are concerned, the locks were legislated for in the National Insurance Contributions Rate Ceilings Act 2015. When the bill was introduced, it was made clear by ministers that the lock would apply only to Class 1 contributions. However, it is clear from discussions with colleagues over the last few days that this legislative test of the manifesto commitment does not meet a wider understanding of the spirit of that commitment. Therefore, I have decided not to proceed with the Class 4 NICS measures set out in the budget. There will be no increases in national insurance contribution rates in this Parliament.
Whoops.
I think the Chancellor is quite right to get out of it and to drop the idea as quickly as possible, because it was going to prove, firstly, very, very unpopular, and secondly, I just wonder whether he would got it through the House of Commons very easily. So better to stop digging when you're in a hole and move on and try and forget about it as quickly as possible. But yes, of course, it's been damaging.
That was former Tory Chancellor Lord Norman Lamont there. Well, don't worry, there were plenty of things that we did tell you about in the budget that will stick around. No change on the cut in dividend allowance from £5,000 a year to £2,000. We're also getting a hike in the flat rate VAT scheme introduced over a decade ago to make life easier for businesses. Now it's going up from 14.5% to 16.5% next month, ostensibly to crack down on big firms manipulating their accounts to pay less tax. But you say it will hit small businesses. This is hard. First of all, Simon, just a quick one about the U-turn. How on earth did this come about?
How did it come about? I think it came about for the reasons of what we were discussing on the radio show last week after the budget, which was this question of why on earth would you stage a tax raid on small businesses and the self-employed? Now, if you're going to do that, you need to have a really good reason for doing it. And you probably want to kind of very gently trail it. And what you don't want to do is deliver one of the dullest budgets in living memory, apart from the attack, the orchestrated attack on small businesses and the self-employed in the middle of it, which is going to generate you some bad headlines and a backlash, especially from those small businesses, from the self-employed, from your traditional support, from who see you as the party of the working man who wants to get ahead kind of thing, from your own backbench MPs. And I think that what we've seen here is a very interesting sort of division since the budget, where you've got lots of economists and think tanks on one side saying, well, no, this is a perfectly good idea and it's very sensible. There should be this evening out. We'd like to move towards, you know, rationalising this system, you know, this is a very good idea, he should stick to his guns kind of thing. And the emotional reaction from other people who have said, why are you staging a tax raid on the self-employed? What have they done wrong? Because the rhetoric that came through in the budget was one of, look at these self-employed not paying their way. You know, and also there has been this change to the flat rate VAT scheme. There was this crackdown on the dividends. All of it is aimed at people who are earning pots of money, and it's not really going to affect people who are earning pots of money. It's the people who are earning 20, 22 grand a year who are feeling that they're being squeezed. And so it comes down to, if you were going to try and even up the national insurance thing, which maybe there is an argument for doing that because people get the same state pension nowadays, but you need to look into it properly. And that's when you consider the things such as, as a, you know, sole trader, you don't get holiday pay, you don't get maternity pay, you don't get sick pay, you don't get pension contributions, which are now the law your employer has to contribute to. It's on you to pay for all of that stuff. I mean, you can have it, but you have to foot the bill for it. So maybe we should have looked at those things as well and had a proper look at it. And apparently we are having a proper look at it, but instead of waiting for the proper look at it and having a proper discussion about it, like adults, where we said, well, look, you know, you are paying less, maybe you should pay more. We just dumped it in the middle of a really boring budget and everyone went mad about it. And so, unsurprisingly, within a week, there was a screeching U-turn. There is rubber left on the tarmac outside number 11 Downing Street. And Philip Hammond, embarrassingly, had to go before Parliament and say that the centrepiece of his budget would no longer be going ahead because someone had noticed that in their manifesto it did say they wouldn't put this tax up. And whilst they had tried to weasel out of it with some of the small print in the legislation, they did think that maybe, seeing as if a bank tried to do this, the Ombudsman wouldn't find in the bank's favour, it would find in your favour, and it should have just like stuck to the thing that it wrote in the large print. Maybe they'd better ditch this. And in all honesty, this is not an ideal scenario to be in when you are trying to negotiate such an important thing as Brexit.
Yeah,
it makes us look really stupid.
I would suggest, especially when you say you only really noticed it when you were watching the BBC, didn't he say? So, but it's okay, Rachel. Look, there was no problem with the manifesto. You know, they did stick to it by the letter of the law. It's just the spirit he was talking about. I mean, maybe Simon said, you know, it was a dull budget. Perhaps if he'd thrown in there some National Insurance ISA thing, no one would have noticed.
No. Because it's to attack entrepreneurs and small businesses at this time from a Tory government that prides itself on supporting those people. It's never going to go unnoticed. He tried to do, it seems to me, what chancellors do again and again at the moment. We've got this awful situation whereby the hands are tied of chancellors at the moment. They can't increase national insurance, VAT or income tax, and they're skint. And they are the three main sources of money. So what we have instead are all these peculiar, weird little taxes that they hope that no one knows much about and that they can increase without anyone paying much attention because they're so boring, like IPT. What is IPT? Or, you know, no one really knew until about a year ago when suddenly it became a cash cow.
And everyone's insurances have gone up.
Yeah, exactly. All of these short-sighted measures to pick on little bits and bobs all over the place because there's no other way of doing it. I understand why they have to do it. And in theory, it should be such a powerful job, shouldn't it, to be chancellor? But really, there's so little you can do when all you can do is just tweak bits and here and there and scrounge from people you think won't notice as much. But his... I just found myself kicking the table listening to his justification for it all. I think he is in a bind. What is wrong with just being a bit candid about it? And people are so wary of politicians and were so angry about that. Why not just say, do you know what? We've thought about it. We're a government who listens to people. We do like to support working people who work hard, who drive the economy. No, you're not so convinced.
Because as Simon says, it's not like they can sort of go full throttle with Brexit and then afterwards go, do you know what, we've thought about it and actually we haven't got the best deal. But it's okay because everyone will be really reasonable and allow us... No, they won't. Should they not have done all these checks and balances before he stood up and gave the budget?
Yeah, but that's not what chancellors like to do because there's less drama, isn't there, when people know about it.
I'm confident Philip Hammond would prefer not to have the drama, though.
You say that, but and we all thought that, and I think that perhaps we think that so much of him because we we typecast spreadsheet Phil before he even started. And now he gets in and he starts telling jokes. He's obviously someone who does like a little bit of a spectacle as well.
Simon, goodness me. All right, some of those little tweaks that Rachel was talking about there, the ways to get money. We talked there about the dividend allowance last week, that being cut. Also, a hike in the flat rate VAT scheme. What's going on here?
OK, well, so this is something that was announced in the autumn statement, and not a lot of people are really going to know about this, and it doesn't affect huge numbers of people. But I think there's something very important here, which is the flat rate VAT scheme was brought in more than 10 years ago, basically to help small businesses, businesses with a turnover of less than £150,000, so the very smallest. And VAT is a massive headache for businesses. Now, the way that VAT works is you sell someone a good or a service, say for £100, and it's £100, then you add the 20% VAT on, so that's an extra £20. So the person that you sell it to, be it, say, if it's another business, pays £120, but they can then claim back the VAT that they paid you. But you, because you're VAT registered, can claim back the VAT that you paid someone who sold you something for the purpose of your business, and so on. But you've got to basically balance up all of these figures, do a load of accounting around it, file a VAT return every 3 months, and it is a major headache for businesses. So what the idea behind the flat rate scheme was to come up with this system whereby, basically, instead of having to do all of that, you signed up to flat rate VAT and you charge 20% VAT and then you hand over a certain percentage to the government. And it's done on different percentages for different types of business. Now, the way it works is the 14.5%. It sounds like you're keeping 5.5% of the VAT. And this is this buffer that you get. But you're not really keeping 5.5% of the VAT because the 14.5% is calculated on the total cost of what you sell to someone. So say you take that £100 example. You charge £100. Then you add the 20% VAT, so the person pays 120, and then the 14.5% is worked out on the 120, mm-hmm. not just on the VAT. And what they're doing is they're shifting this limit up from 14.5% to 16.5%. And effectively what that means is that the buffer is going to shrink. So, for example, in a certain instance where the buffer previously would have been £26, the buffer is now going to be £2. And it's going to affect businesses that are considered limited cost businesses. Certain percentage of your turnover is goods that you buy. But anyway, the point of this is it's removed a very popular scheme with these small businesses that they find very, very useful and turned it into something that most of them are probably just going to drop out of because they say it's not worth their while being signed up to it anymore. And now they're going to have the headache of doing VAT returns and everything like that. So it's really, really unpopular amongst small businesses. And the reason why it was introduced, apparently, is because big businesses are using it to their own advantage and gaming the system. So we've cracked down on the small businesses that it's helping, or we've harmed the small businesses that it's helping, collateral damage, in order to crack down on big business.
Isn't that what a lot of his measures, though?
Exactly the same thing with this tax-free dividend allowance that he's done. The tax-free dividend allowance is to do with all these people setting themselves up as companies, paying themselves dividends instead of being paid a salary to dodge tax. Now, the people who that's really going to hurt is actually the people who genuinely run small businesses or do lots of different work for lots of different people and actually should be entitled to some of the entrepreneurial benefit of being able to take a lower tax rate on dividends. And it was only introduced because they hiked the dividend tax to crack down on this. So there's just a load of collateral damage, which is genuine small businesses and small investors who've built up, you know, pots of money and shares, often retired people to live on. And they're collateral damage because this is a crackdown on people further up the scale. And then you've got this shift to self-employment. Well, if you look at this shift to self-employment, you know, some of it is just about flexibility in the labour market and changes after the financial crisis. Some of it, the bit that the government's actually worried about, is to do with people dodging tax. But this little tweak to the national insurance isn't going to affect those people who are dodging the tax. It's going to affect the people who are genuinely self-employed. So I think that if you want to do something, so I think the message that's being sent out at the moment to the self-employed and small businesses is very mixed, very confused, and they're not happy about it. But if you want to do this stuff, you need to trail it slowly. You need to bring it in. If you do want to do this levelling of the national insurance, you should say to people, look, we are in a bit of a bind, like Rachel said. Mm. We're short of cash. What you're doing is you're paying less national insurance, and we don't think that you should be paying less national insurance because you do get the same, you know, pension benefits. But we're going to look into this, and we might ask you to pay the same because we do need to bring some more money in. And we did make this manifesto pledge, but that wasn't what we were talking about. We were talking about the national insurance that employees pay. So we're going to look at this, and maybe in the autumn statement, you know, which is now going to be the autumn budget, isn't it?
Yep.
Can't remember. We might do this. What you don't do, I think, is what Philip Hammond has done with both the flat rate VAT scheme and the tax-free dividend allowance and national insurance contributions over the past 6 months, which is just smack them in the face with it.
Well, you say it's a mixed message. Isn't the message to small businesses, entrepreneurs, the self-employed, they don't really know what they're doing?
No, it's really tough being self-employed, and you don't get paid for those hours that you spend doing your VAT and your tax returns and your invoicing and all that kind of stuff. They need a bit of a boost, and it's just so mean that, you know, it's just like at school when something's cancelled, like your swimming lessons, because a couple of bullies have been splashing around in the deep end, you know? Why pick on everyone just because of a few? And the one thing we know about companies that don't like to pay tax is if a loophole is closed, they will find another. It's not like they'll say, well, that's it, fair enough. We'll just pay more tax, Hammond, no problem. They will find a way. And so does he just, you know, play whack-a-mole with every...
Hydra-headed, isn't it?
Exactly. They will find the next way to do it. And it's not fair that the people who end up suffering from the misdemeanours of a few bigger businesses are the self-employed.
Yeah, just I think the final thing I wanted to say on this, I give a shout-out to the blog Monivator, right, who also... gave us a shout out in their weekend reading last week about saying that This Is Money podcast is something that they always enjoy listening to. But there was a great post written in their weekend reading, which every Saturday they sum up the best stuff to read that week. And it said basically that the real problem with this and policy in general over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, it does appear to be being made up on the hoof. Basically.
Shock.
You know, but it does. And it's just constant tinkering. So it says here, I suspect Hammond may be secretly planning to launch a 24/7 365 budget, one long unending rollercoaster of financial meddling, streamed on Facebook and pithily summarised via hourly tweets. So relentless have been the changes to pensions, taxes and whatnot in recent years, it must be a drag for them to have to sit around waiting for another budget to come along before they can have a fiddle again. Instead, why not just get the latest wheezes out the door pronto? We had just-in-time manufacturing for years. Let's have just-in-time policy. It can't take long to get the back of a fag packet typed up. Lifetime ISAs, I'm looking at you.
Very,
sums it up.
Very true. No, it absolutely does. But another tax change that you may not be aware of that will also definitely be coming in relates to our wheels. Let's talk about that now. And as of next month, almost all new cars will be subject to annual tax band price revisions, going up as high as £2,000 in the first year for the most polluting models. This will hit 17 plate cars bought from April. Tom Denton from the Institute of Motor Industry explains some of the problems.
There's going to be something called a showroom tax. So the new cars that produce higher emissions will have a larger tax when you first buy them. So to some extent, they are still pushing people towards the lower emissions. But the system just seems dreadfully complicated, really. There's a few anomalies in this, in that cars over a certain price, which I think at the moment is about £40,000, are going to have an even bigger hike on them, the idea being perhaps if you can afford a big car, you can afford more tax. But the trouble is that's still going to affect cars like the latest Tesla, which is a zero-emission vehicle, of course, being fully electric, and that's going to have a huge amount of extra tax put on it. So perhaps just like when the government changed the tax on diesel, there are always unintended consequences of these things.
Aren't there just? Well, as your motoring correspondent Rob Hull points out, actually the majority of British drivers are completely unaware of the car tax changes. So briefly, what's going on here, Rachel?
It's such a mess. I really tried to get my head round with this one and I still am slightly in the dark about it. It's so convoluted. No wonder no one knows that it's happening. And if they do know, they don't really understand what's going to happen anyway. But all sorts of incentives are changing round again. So hybrid cars used to have higher tax breaks and they'll be cut. That there's still... The only cars that won't be affected, I think, are the completely zero emissions ones, except if they cost over, I think it's 40 grand a year. in which case they too will be stung, and that is, you know, covers things like that the Tesla that was just spoken about. It's so messy. It just seems to be another one of these things where you make it as complicated as possible so no one really knows what's going on or argues about it. And it's only later than they say, hang on, that's more than I thought. And then, you know, well, we're there to say we told you so. And Hammond gets another few hundred million in the pot.
Well, Tom Denton there likened it to the diesel tax, so it would be remiss of me not to come to you, Simon, and get your thoughts.
Well, this is the product of our former Chancellor and a man who's now claimed himself his sixth job, George Osborne, who is now the editor of the Evening Standard, we have discovered. And I believe that this policy was dreamed up after he'd run out of room on his cigarette packet. So that's why it may look so messy. The issue behind this was because of the car tax system favouring low CO2 vehicles, which is behind the shift towards diesel. It was too successful. There were too many low CO2 diesels, so the car tax take was falling. So lots of people were basically paying either nothing for their car tax or about 30 or 40 quid. So they needed to bring in something else. So they've come up with this bonkers system where the first year there's a showroom tax, which is graded on emissions, so you could pay £2,000. But then after that first year, all cars go to a flat rate of £140 unless they are pure electric cars and so have zero emissions. So, OK, right, we've established here pure electric cars, good, yes?
Right.
But there's a kicker. Pure electric cars costing more than £40,000, bad.
Why?
Because if you buy a car costing more than £40,000, you have to pay an extra £310 a year premium rate surcharge in years 2 to 6 of ownership, so after the first year. Are you keeping up with this?
Oh, you've lost me at the budget one.
Yeah,
about VAT.
So it's created a slightly bizarre system where basically you could find yourself buying one of Britain's most popular hybrid vehicles, non-polluting vehicles, the Mitsubishi Outlander PHEV, which costs more than £40,000. You will be taxed heavily for that, presumably because if you buy a car that costs more than £40,000, you are rich and you deserve to be taxed for completely random things. However, if you buy a Ford Mustang with a 5-litre V8 engine, wonderful car as it though it is, hugely polluting, that only costs £35,000, so you will be a winner in the new car tax lottery stakes. And it's full of weird contradictions like that. And I think this is exactly the kind of tax that we should definitely be ditching completely. And we talked about this a few weeks ago, and I said it would be a much better idea if we ditched car tax, just added something onto the cost of petrol and diesel, and that would have the benefit of making sure that the people who drove the most paid the most. And I wrote a column about it, and bizarrely, there was a load of comments on the bottom of it that said this is a good idea, not you're an idiot, which is what the comments normally say on the bottom of our articles.
Surely not. I do remember from a previous episode, though, you did offer your services to George Osborne, and I imagine you offer the similar service to the Chancellor, the new Chancellor, Philip Hammond. If he's listening, Simon.
Yeah, I'm in all seriousness, I don't think it would be a bad idea for someone in authority to get someone in as a sort of sense test for some of this stuff, so that when they come up with these things, there is someone who sits there, an outsider, someone not, you know, enmeshed in the machinations of government and the civil service, who just puts their hands up and goes, sorry, this one sounds like a stupid idea. And if that's it, someone puts their hands up and says, sorry, this one sounds like a stupid idea, they just have to kill it off straight there, or come up and to all basically tweak it until it sounds like a better idea. Because there's an almighty amount of stuff coming out that just sounds like a really stupid idea at the moment.
Yeah, like the BBC's Laura Koonsberg that said, I'm not sure this is allowed according to your manifesto. Simon Lambert, Personal Finance Editor, Rachel Rickard-Strauss.
This is Money, in partnership with NS&I. Have any premium bond prizes you win paid directly into your bank account.
I'm Georgie Frost. Here with me is the team from This Is Money for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. In the studio, editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Now, amongst all the gloomy tax news, there's been some positive stats out this week. Official figures showing a surprise dip in the UK's jobless rate in the 3 months to January, falling to its lowest level since 2005.
4.7% unemployment, the lowest for 12 years. Last time it was lower, was in the mid-1970s. We've got a new high in terms of the number of people in work, and the growth, recent growth in jobs has been all about full-time work, and we've seen sustained falls in the types of unemployment we, of course, are most concerned about, namely youth unemployment and long-term unemployment. So, yes, it is encouraging. It shows, I think, the underlying strength of the UK economy.
Employment Minister Damien Hines there, a sign of the strength of the economy. Well, perhaps one member of the Bank of England might agree. Kristen Forbes, a member of the Monetary Policy Committee, voted to raise rates this month, but she was alone. Wage growth, if you look in more detail at those figures, is a concern. And there's also a record number of people, 905,000 to be exact, on those controversial zero-hour contracts for their main jobs. So, Rachel, just want to get your views on the unemployment figures.
And they're really good. Record again. And the one that always, I think, well, maybe I would, but I find it the most upsetting is the kids who come out of work who can't find jobs. And those numbers have plummeted. They're about around the national average, I think. So just under 5%. Yes, we are seeing huge changes to our workforce with increase in zero hours contract and that's contracts. And that's something really to watch as well. But in terms of a barometer for the resilience of the UK economy, I think they're looking pretty good.
So by and large, you're okay with that. What about wage growth, though?
Well, it's rubbish.
Yeah.
And it has been for years. Mm. And that doesn't seem to be going anywhere very quickly. We call it the productivity puzzle, whereby everyone seems to be in jobs, but productivity is still relatively low and we're not seeing wage growth that you might start to hope to see as our economy builds up strength. It's going to be a huge problem going forward, just if inflation continues to rise. If the value of your money is decreasing and you're not getting more money, then that's going to be a problem. And our economy seems to be, well, lots of people's finances seem to be pretty precariously balanced anyway. High levels of debt, less job security for many people, and lots of people working part-time when they don't want to be. It means that the impact of rising inflation is likely to be greater just because we don't have the sort of support from wage growth that matches it.
Simon, a sign of the state of the economy, the strength of the economy?
Difficult to say, really, isn't it, without wages going up? That's the real problem. Is that to do with our low productivity? Is it a function of our low productivity? Is it a function of the things that led many people in parts of the country that aren't the prosperous areas of London and the South East to vote for Brexit? I think it's probably a combination of all of those things, but I don't think that we can lay any claim to any form of proper recovery from the financial crisis until people's wages start going up properly. And this has long been a major concern for the Bank of England. And I think that their real concern, you know, in the times of the deflation days, the worries about deflation, how long ago that seems now, was that companies would use it as an excuse to pay people less. Now we've had inflation bounce back and we've got a problem where, you know, you've got people being paid below inflation wage increases. So I don't really know how you find your way out of this one, but I think it's a problem not just for Britain, but it's a problem for large parts of the developed Western world.
All right, then what about raising interest rates? Should we do in America and do what the Fed is doing, raising interest rates by 0.25%? We didn't this week, we heard.
No, but one person thought we should do. I know. Ructions. Amazing.
Will others follow
suit? We could hike interest rates right back up to that 0.5% level where they sat for all those years. Yeah.
No. So why not?
Why not? Why not raise?
Should they raise it? Well, why did they not? And should they?
It's a difficult question, that, because I thought they should have raised them before they cut them in the first place. So I think that what we should have done is started trying to inch them up. There's this obsession with 0.25% moves. And one of the reasons that gets bandied around is because if you move by less than that, apparently it's too complicated for banks. So, hey-ho, we're not in hock to the banks anymore, are we? I think we should start inching them up. I think we should start getting interest rates up. I think you can't lay any claim to be back to normal or recovering until you get interest rates up off the floor, as well as getting wages up off the floor. So I think low interest rates are probably causing as many problems as benefits, if not causing more problems than the benefits that they're delivering. So Yeah, but I can't see that. But having said that, I can't see them going anywhere anytime soon in this country.
Well, even if the Bank of England keeps the base rate on hold, we're being warned mortgage rates could be about to edge up this year and into next year. It's all to do with how most banks and building societies price their mortgages based on their costs of funds. Saying that, though, this week, Yorkshire Building Society launched a market-leading 0.99% deal, but you'll need a 40% deposit and $1,500 for the fee. Here's personal finance expert Hannah Maundrell from money.co.uk.
This is just another one of those examples where, you know, this is a great headline rate that mortgage rates are so low for some people at the moment and in general. But actually, what the deal is, it's not about waiting to see if rates fall lower. It's actually about saying, well, if I've got a mortgage right now, am I on my lender's standard variable rate? Does that mean that I'm paying a crazy amount too much for my mortgage and in mortgage interest? Yes, probably. Should I switch to a new deal? Yes, it's quite likely to save you money. I think, you know, yes, interest rates might start rising later in the year. It's possible. Equally, because there's such fierce competition within that sector, we are still likely to see some lenders, you know, push for those best buy table topping rates. It's about looking at what you're paying on your mortgage right now and asking whether you can get a better deal. And if so, moving forward with that as swiftly as possible, because ultimately that money is better in your pockets than in the banks.
Well, I'll find out more about the cost of funds in a short while, but Rachel, just tell us a little bit more about this offering from Yorkshire Building Society.
It sounds so cool, doesn't it? 0.99, sub 1% is insane. And they are very pleased with themselves, the Yorkshire Building Society.
Give us some context. There's some historical context of what 0.99 really means. For anyone who's not bought a house or doesn't know about this.
We flirted with 0.99% before. I think HSBC has tried it out. But it's still
very
low.
How high were they in the past?
Oh, I mean, in the 80s, yeah. They went easily into double digits. You know, always you hear people talking about, well, when I bought my first house, a number of times I've been told that. We're very used now to low rates, and so perhaps it doesn't sound as gobsmacking. But yes, you're right. If you put it into a historical context, it's incredible. Mm. But of course, headline number sounds great. You have to still work out if it's the right deal for you once you've added in the 1,400 and something fee that goes with it. That has a considerable impact as well. And it is there are limits on the number of people who it would benefit, because you have to have quite a lot of equity in your home already. So it's not necessarily the best thing. But it's just interesting that I remember a few months ago we were talking about all the tides are turning, rates are going to start going up. And actually the number of times we've been told, fix now, it's all going to start going back up again. We've never had it so good. And here we are back again at 0.99%.
And back again asking, should we fix? Are mortgage rates going to go up? Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult question for people, isn't it?
It is. And it's funny because they just keep going lower and lower. And it's the same as the FTSE at the moment, going high and high. Each time it's a record low, at which point we think, well, surely they can't go lower. Surely now is the time to fix. But they go on. And it's the same as ISA rates. Surely they can't go lower until you end up with 0.01%. Mm-hmm. And you realise that, yes, they could have gone lower. But having said that, 0.99%. Surely it can't go lower than that.
Surely. But, I mean, maybe it's the last one that's going to be that low, Simon. There's an article on your website which says rates could be about to head up, but not to do with the Bank of England. This is about the cost of funds. So you're going to have to explain, what does that mean?
Well, because basically the Bank of England's base rate doesn't really, you know, directly influence what mortgage rate that you were offered, unless you were on a tracker rate that tracks the Bank of England's mortgage rate, base rate. But even then, that tracker, the margin that it tracks the base rate, is going to be influenced by other things. And those other things are basically the cost of banks and building societies getting their hands on money. Mm. And an awful lot of the money that flows into the hands of mortgage borrowers is not generated by savers putting money into banks and building societies, as most people think. It is generated by banks and building societies borrowing money on the money markets themselves. And the cost of funds relates to the cost of getting that money on the money markets. And the cost of that is going up slightly because everybody expects there to be slightly higher inflation. The US is raising interest rates, so that puts... And there's this worry about inflation in the US, and that puts inflation at the forefront of everyone's minds, including the sort of money market investing world. And so people are demanding a higher interest rate on money on the money markets. And eventually that will filter through to people. But we've had these kind of warnings about rates going up for quite some time, and they just keep bumping along on the floor. And that's because actually what we are seeing in the mortgage market and have been seeing for the past few years is banks and building societies genuinely competing with each other to try and pull in mortgage borrowers. And whilst they keep doing that, you're going to see mortgages continue to be pretty cheap. And also the Bank of England has chucked a load of money at banks and building societies post-Brexit when it was trying to do all the things to stave off the terrible apocalypse that would hit the economy and didn't. Although, I think just to put a bit of context into where a 0.99% interest rate on your mortgage sits in the grand scheme of things, I have here in front of me an article from the 17th of July, 2007. Has your mortgage rate risen? Written by yours truly, I believe. Homeowners are facing yet another hike in their mortgage bills after the Bank of England opted to raise the bank rate to 5.75%, the fifth increase in less than a year. And then what we used to do is round up what the SVRs were and who'd moved their SVRs up. Had they done it by the full amount? Had they done it by less than the full amount? Were they doing the dirty on people? So I'm just looking down this list. Cheltenham and Gloucester has raised its standard variable rate by 0.25% to 7.75%. Pick out another big one. What we got here, Lloyds TSB. Nationwide has raised its mortgage rate by 0.25% to 7.24%. So not that long ago, 10 years ago, in fact, people were paying over 7% on their mortgages. So that puts a 0.99% two-year fixed rate into context, doesn't it? So if you are paying too much money on your mortgage, do consider moving it, because mortgages are really, really cheap at the moment. Unfortunately, this is not doing the problem that we have in this country with house prices any favours whatsoever.
Just thinking, like, that must have been one of your first articles.
I've been knocking around this as money for a year or two by that point.
Okay, well, meanwhile, banks, you mentioned there they're fighting to pull in people to get mortgages and the like, but they're not fighting to pull in savers. Record low interest rates have had an impact on savers and will continue to do so, but are dire rates on savings accounts of late pushing us to invest? Well, not according to Santander, who say just 1 in 10 of us do, so why not? The research also shows on average we're saving £150 a month, but rather worryingly, 1 in 5 of us have no savings whatsoever to fall back on. His personal finance expert, Kevin White.
The figures are startling, really. And as a nation, we're not a nation of savers, we're a nation of spenders. A lot of the news is about how bad savings rates are. People think, well, there's no point saving then. The most important thing is to have some money put away somewhere, regardless of whether you're getting a return on it or not. You're best off having something of some kind. There's two types of people. There's savers and investors. Savers is what you do first. A 999, a rainy day fund in a bank account somewhere, whether it be a cash ISA, which makes sense straight away. And once you've got, typically I would say, 3 to 6 months outgoings in that rainy day fund, then you can potentially look at investing. And that would be more for your long-term growth, you know, whether it be retirement or children's education and those sort of things. But the most important thing is to save something, because actually, as soon as you've got even a little bit in a bank account, it makes a difference then to add another £50, £100, £150 to it. It's that starting it and getting into that routine, which is always the hardest.
Rachel, I've asked you this more than once as to why people aren't investing. Are there changes? Are we getting signs that people are with these low savings rates, perhaps?
It doesn't look like it yet, according to these latest figures. But something's got to give. I mean, we must get to a point at which people realise that the returns that they're getting on their savings are just not even worth thinking about. But also, there's just a proliferation of offerings for people who aren't traditional investors. Easier platforms, really, where you don't even have to know very much. You just have to know what you want to do with your money, and how risk averse you are and when you're roughly going to need to use it. And if you can answer all of that, there are so many different options for people. But I think that still, I mean, I've been investing a bit recently. Most people I tell about, when I tell them about it, they say, oh, isn't that like gambling? They really are worried.
That's still the prevailing attitude.
They think I'm gambling. Yeah, and it's seen as risky as going down the casino. So I think, I don't know what it will take, whether it's sort of more awareness, education. I think a lot of it will happen naturally with so many of these different platforms telling everyone that it's an all right thing to do. And it's a very different attitude in the States, so it is possible.
But do people know what happens to pensions, by and large?
No, not at all. I mean, I just find that the most extraordinary thing, that one of the most important decisions that we make as consumers is where we're investing that money, and no one has a clue what they're investing in. I'm sure if people, you know, knew the types of stuff that they were giving money to, they'd be a bit shocked about it. But no one ever scrutinises, do they, what goes into their pensions? And that's the other side of it as well with investing, that there's sort of two decisions to make. There's what you want your money to do for you, and what you want your money to do for companies, for the environment, all those sorts of issues as well, which is also just not really considered so much.
Well, you said there's lots of options. What about classic cars? Rare wine, Simon? You've been looking at that this week?
Yeah, we have. Our colleagues on Money Mail have been running a series of features in the middle of the paper through the week, looking at various things around saving and investing, and one of them was to do with wine and classic cars. But it was a good article, actually, because it took a slightly more sober view of this than many articles, which can be a little bit gung-ho occasionally on these subjects of investing in collectibles, because everybody likes these stories. I mean, you know, if you like wine and you like cars, not necessarily at the same time, then why not, you know, put some money into a car, maybe? Why not put some money into some wine if you want to get interested in it? And you hear these stories about people making large returns. But really, it's only the very top end of the market where a lot of this stuff refers to. There's a wine index called the Livex Index, and it tracks the most expensive bottles of wine in the world. And realistically, it's kind of unlikely that you're going to be buying into those. Also, there's a lot of very bold claims made around this. And in fact, this week, there was a story about a wine broker who I believe might have been jailed, actually, for perpetrating some form of fraud to do with basically telling people you'll make loads of money, and they weren't. And the only person who made loads of money, in the short term at least, was the crooked wine broker. So you've got to be really careful around these things. And cars, for example, I've got a classic car, a modern classic car, a Peugeot 205 GTI, and basically, it costs a load of money to keep a car on the road. Old cars break down all the time. And the only way that they don't break down is if you don't use them. And that's only because you don't know they haven't broken down because you haven't tried to start it. So there are quite a few costs involved in it. And that car has gone up in value in the time that I've owned it. But I've probably spent as much on it as it's gone up in value. And I bought it because I wanted to enjoy it. But all of these things are purely priced on sentiment.
I was wondering, can I ask you, was it Peter Lynch? Who is the fund manager that said, if you go into a Starbucks and you like the coffee, get involved with that? So maybe if you like the wine, you think,
that's scuttlebutt, isn't it? That's the term for that kind of stuff. Yeah. Learning from what you see in everyday life. And that's to do with you go into the supermarket, you see a product that's doing really, really well. And you think, oh, who sells that product? Have a look at that company. Hmm. You know, is that company doing well? That kind of thing. I think you've got to be very careful about buying into things that you have a passion for or a love of, because you can find that outweighs the sensible part of you. And these things are bought on sentiment. So, for example, the fine wine prices are up quite a bit over, if you look at it, I think over 5 years. But what that masks is at one point they were up quite a lot and then they sank loads because there was a big crackdown in China on bribery. And the traditional thing in China was basically you bought people expensive stuff and you were very showy. And one of the things that was driving the market for very, very expensive bottles of wine was the Chinese market and some of this gift giving and show offery and stuff like that. And there was a big crackdown and it absolutely torpedoed the market for a while. So if you look at that index, you'll see that it went up a lot and then it went down a lot as well. And that's just an example of how sentiment can change. It might be, for example, that at the moment, you know, the cost of a Jaguar E-Type has gone up by loads and loads and loads and loads. Mm-hmm. But that can change very quickly because that Jaguar E-Type, whilst it's rare and it's in demand and people love them, is purely based on sentiment. And if that sentiment suddenly changes, then you could suddenly find that your £100,000 Jaguar E-Type could only be sold for £70,000.
All right, Simon, take a deep breath because we've got 2 minutes and you've been tapping away on your laptop for your minor investor column this week. Five of the best Dividend Hero investment trusts to consider for an ISA. Goodness, that was difficult to say. OK, so your 2 minutes starts now. Go.
Well, it's pretty bad ISA season. If you thought the cash ISA season last year was bad, you ain't seen nothing yet. And we joked a few weeks ago about NatWest and its ISA countdown clock that then led you through to a 0.05% rate. Well, when I checked and went to use a screen grab of it this week for my column, I discovered that it now leads counts you down to a 0.01% rate, which sums it up. So the purely anecdotal minor investor sentiment index, based on conversations I have with people, I think more people are considering investing. But the problem they face is, OK, right, I've decided I'm going to invest some money. It's not the money I need for the boiler, packing up, or to buy a house in the short term, all those things. So I can invest it, but then they're like, oh, I don't know where to put it. And so there's many places that you could start. One place you could start is the Dividend Heroes list that came out this week from the AIC, the Association of Investment Companies. And these are investment trusts with the longest history of raising their dividends. That doesn't make them a great investment in itself, but it means that they've had the, you know, the commitment and the backbone to stick it out and pay investors a higher dividend every year. And I picked five out that look quite interesting. And I can't really sum them up in the detail that's needed to here, so I'd advise you to go to thisismoney.co.uk and look for the article. The easiest place to find it is thisismoney.co.uk/DIY investing. But you've got City of London, which has increased its dividend for 50 years in a row. That pays a yield of 3.9% and has ongoing charges of just 0.43%. That's a cheap investment. You've got Temple Bar, which is a different, takes a different strategy, contrarian manager who tries to look for cheap companies that are undervalued by the market but have strong balance sheets, that you can buy at a discount to its net asset value of nearly 4%, so you're buying it for less than some of its parts. That's raised its dividend for 33 years in a row, and that yields 3.2%. All of those are considerably better than the return you'll get on your cash ISA. The trade-off for that is that one day you might open your investing account and discover that there's less than you put in, but over the long term, you should probably do quite well with one of these. And if you are looking for an investment, it's not a bad place to start. But do your own research, think about it yourself, read what you need to read, look at the fact sheets, read the prospectuses. If you don't understand, seek professional financial advice. Don't ever just buy something because someone else said that they thought it was a good idea.
Do you know, we started talking about best bosses and I said it's good to have people that are more intelligent than you. But do you know what, Simon? I think you'd really struggle. Well, not many people know more than Simon Lambert. Perhaps personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss, thank you so much for joining us.
Did you know premium bonds have been around for 60 years? I recently won £100 in the monthly prize draw. I was off to the bank to deposit my prize warrant when my granddad came over. You know you can do all that online nowadays, he chuckled. And he was right. I now manage my premium bonds online, and I've chosen to have my winnings paid straight into my bank account. It's so much faster. You can too by visiting nsandi.com.